From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for February the 5th, 2017, the first Sunday in February. Yes, this is our Super Sunday look into the politics and policies that make Chicago, Illinois, and Washington tick. So, time to grab the Sunday paper, go get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll try to get your day and week off to a good beginning. Yeah, I know it's Super Bowl Sunday. I mean, I get it, but I don't have an interest in this at all.
Is it simply because you don't have an interest in either of the teams?
Well, I mean, I certainly have a square on a board somewhere.
You do, okay.
but even that isn't really, I just don't, maybe it's just because of such a lackluster season by the Bears.
That might be it, yeah.
This has not been like, a real interest in the NFL this year.
You'll miss football when it's gone.
I will?
Yes, you'll miss it. When it's, no football until August after today.
Well,
he's right.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
But we'll have other things to take our mind off football.
Like the presidency.
Well, I wasn't going to go there. Well, I mean, there's plenty of political footballs to be kicked around, that's for sure. But
nuclear football?
There's the nuclear football. Very good. And thankfully, I maintain the belief that the nuclear code is actually longer than 140 characters. That would be very helpful to all of us.
Sam, refresh our memory here. Spring training starts next week, a week and a half?
February 15th.
The 15th, right. That's what I figured. Pitchers and catchers, right?
That's what they report, yeah. Some of them are already down there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I mean,
are you at least excited to eat today, Rick? I mean, come on, give me something.
Well, yes. I mean, I was curious. What do you guys got planned? I mean, I know what I'm doing. By the way, an estimated 1.3 billion chicken wings to be devoured today. 1.3 billion.
Never mind the story I just ran on Super Bowl.
I know. And I heard that, too.
We blanked it out. When you talk calories, I stop listening.
Well, you know, you can do naked wings.
No.
What?
You could.
With the breading and stuff?
No.
No, naked wings and with the sauce. That's the way to go. That's the real chicken wings. Not all that fancy breading stuff. Sorry. That's how you do a chicken wing. Next. No, I'm thinking of actually like chicken and sausage jambalaya today.
Hey, that's not bad.
How about that?
Sounds good.
Because it's almost like, you know, we're going to be pushing almost 40 today, and it's not cold enough for a big pot of chili.
It's sunny.
Yeah.
And yeah, okay.
I mean,
I'll be over later.
Well, Dave and I actually already had some chicken wings this morning, thanks to
yes, we did, didn't we?
Thanks to Dave Plyer leaving some around here, and so best Super Bowl food I've had all morning.
That means you're off to a good start then.
Yeah.
No, you ask about plans. There are several parties in the neighborhood. I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet.
So, are you bringing any food?
I'll bring something. You know, I can just run down and buy something. You know me.
yes. The great chef of the hot bar. I don't get too creative, Dave. You know, you don't want to do that.
Well, I should tell you both that I used the microwave here to make breakfast this morning. I actually had permission to use it.
And
it went without incident.
And the fire marshal was overseeing
it? No, the fire marshal was not here, and nor did the alarm go off.
Well, that's good news. So you had breakfast on top of the chicken wings?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I'm starting off with Super Bowl Sunday. I'm on a roll here, man.
I guess. Do we need to fill in for you during the newscast while you're getting your latest
food? Well, when you throw it to me and you hear nothing, then you'll know. Sam? Sam's ready to pitch in.
There you go. But, I mean, really, are you really going to watch the game?
I'll watch it, yes.
I'll watch the game.
Well,
yes.
Sam, you'll watch the game. I understand that. But I what is it? Atlanta's a three-point underdog?
Yes. Which, I don't have – the thing is, I kind of get what you're trying to dive into. I'm not rooting for anybody. Like, I don't really care who wins. I will watch, though, because there's something about the possibility of the commissioner of the NFL having to hand the trophy to New England after he went on that goose hunt and suspended Tom Brady for four games. That's quite the story, in my opinion.
No, there is that. And I did see someone posted on Twitter a map of the United States that had red states for Atlanta and then it had Massachusetts in blue. And that was the only who's rooting for who in the Super Bowl. And I don't know if it's that kind of anti-New England that much, because they're just darn good. But I think, if anything, it's an opportunity to see the Falcons, which kind of, I don't know, for I think a lot of people, they were just under the radar.
And they've never won a Super Bowl.
Right.
In team history. New England has four rings. Atlanta has none.
And we only have one.
Okay, you had to go there again.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, I couldn't even... I was going to put on my Bears jersey today, but I thought that would just be mocking if I did that. You know, it's at least there's the ads to watch, you know, including, I guess by now most people have seen that Budweiser ad about the kind of the fictionalized account of Augustus Bush coming
to the
country.
United States. Yeah.
And
I am looking forward to Lady Gaga.
Well,
the performance.
Yes. I didn't picture you as a Gaga fan, Schwann.
Oh, I like Lady Gaga.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think she's very good.
Did you
she's
see the
talented.
Prop? There's a prop in Vegas. Will Lady Gaga say Trump? Yes or no?
Hmm.
Anytime throughout the halftime.
I bet not.
Yes is the favorite.
Yes is the favorite.
It's favored that she will say yes.
Yes is the favorite. I don't think she does either. I think she'll take a shot.
Right.
But I don't think she says Trump.
It'll be a veiled shot. But did you hear this? There was a story I saw that obviously a Super Bowl, the arena is a special events area, national special events area. And so there's no airplanes allowed, no drones or whatever. But I saw this report that they did go to the FAA for an exemption because there's supposed to be, as part of Lady Gaga's halftime, hundreds of lit drones. As part of her performance,
that's scheduled to be part of the performance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are these the drones that fly, or are they just kind of, you know, Lady Gaga sycophants? I don't know. It's just depends what you mean by drones. But yeah, but so you know that yeah halftime. And I was talking to Dave Plyer earlier, and I noted that you know there probably will be perhaps a fall off in the ratings for the Super Bowl, but that you got to imagine the thing spikes at halftime for Lady Gaga.
Yeah. Yeah, it will.
I read this number that from a half an hour before kickoff through the end of the game, an average of 1 million people tune in every minute, another 1 million people.
Oh,
so
kind of adds. And
adding
right.
Up.
It just keeps adding a million people throughout the course of the game.
Well,
usually on average.
And it was $5 million bucks for a 30-second spot, as I understand it. And there's two live commercials too. I guess Hyundai is doing one, and Snickers is doing one. So, how would you like to have you know the $5 million riding on that live commercial? And oh,
something goes
the
wrong.
The satellite yeah. gets out, or
swear
something.
Word.
Yeah, the swear word, something like that.
I have a question though, Schwani. Given the meat theme of the Super Bowl and your new infatuation with Lady Gaga, is she going to wear the meat dress?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know?
I don't know.
She wore that at the MTV Awards. She had that raw beef dress. You remember that?
Yes.
You don't know? You didn't ask her?
No, I didn't. Well, I haven't had a chance to ask her yet. She didn't return my phone call.
This will be the chicken wing costume for today. Yes. Slathered in buffalo sauce. So
hopefully not naked.
Yeah.
Kids are watching.
Exactly. Exactly. There, you do not want a costume malfunction, I think, is the term for that. So That's a super Sunday build up here.
I repeat, garlic parmesan wings with blue cheese dressing. With sauce, have 1.5 times the fat of a Big Mac. A large plate of nachos has more fat than a half stick of butter. I am having a salad this evening.
Oh, please. Oh, I believe that one. That's
iceberg lettuce and green peppers.
And no dressing?
No.
Just like that?
Yep.
Yeah, right. Okay. I want to know the over-under on that one there. Forget that. If you were one of those types that took pictures of your food, I know that that would not be on your plate. Trust me on that one. Oh, man. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news, including the latest calorie counts of the nation. Sam's got all of the sports. Producer Jasmine's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can text us also at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Twitter, at Symbol Sunday Spin. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSundaySpin. And engineer Bob is checking his scores, hoping for the big payout this evening. Remember, if you have to tune away at any time, you can always find the entire show on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes simply by searching for me, Rick Pearson. Well, up ahead today, after Dave brings us the 7:30 news update, we'll be speaking to Todd Mache. Todd is the president and CEO of the Illinois State Chamber of Commerce. The state chamber has expressed concerns about that compromise package that state senators are trying to work on to break that lengthy budget impasse in Springfield. Dave's back with a news update at 8, and then we'll speak to Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. We'll talk to her about the stack of unpaid bills that stare her in the face each day, as well as about the prospects that state workers later this month may not be paid because of court action being undertaken by Attorney General Lisa Madigan. Dave's back with more news at 8:30, and then we'll speak to Rebecca Shee. Rebecca is a great friend of the program. She's the executive director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. And we'll talk to her about all of these activities regarding President Trump's executive orders on migrants, as well as the subsequent court action. That's all coming up, but it's time for a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and there's no shortage of things to talk about. The president nominates a new Supreme Court Justice, Neil Gorsuch. Democrats are lining up in opposition, and the White House says the nuclear option, a majority, not a vote of 60, should be considered for confirmation. There's also the president's phone calls to international leaders, abruptly ending a conversation with Australia's prime minister and warning the Mexican president about trying to send bad hombres to the U.S. and saying the U.S. military might have to come in. And then there are new sanctions being imposed in Iran over its ballistic missile testing. On Friday night, we had the actions of a federal judge in Washington State issuing a sweeping nationwide order blocking the president's executive order on immigration. The Department of Homeland Security announced Saturday it had suspended all the actions to implement the immigration order, and it's resuming standard inspections of travelers as it did prior to the signing of the travel ban. A State Department official also said the department had reversed the cancellation of visas that were provisionally revoked following the president's executive order, so long as those visas were not stamped or marked as canceled, which is what happened to many people who went to the airport following that executive order. So how did the president respond? Well, he criticized, in his words, the, quote, so-called judge, unquote, the judge, federal judge James Robart, a George W. Bush appointee. Now, overnight, the Ninth U.S. Court of Appeals denied an emergency request by the Trump Justice Department to reimpose the executive order. A hearing is scheduled on that tomorrow. So amid all of this, there was the National Prayer Breakfast, a bipartisan event attended by every president since Eisenhower. President Trump showed up and then began talking about how former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger was damaging the ratings for the Celebrity Apprentice TV show.
But we had tremendous success on The Apprentice, and when I ran for president, I had to leave the show. That's when I knew for sure I was doing it. And they hired a big, big movie star, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to take my place. And we know how that turned out. The ratings went right down the tubes. It's been a total disaster. And Mark will never, ever bet against Trump again. And I want to just pray for Arnold, if we can, for those ratings, okay?
That prompted Schwarzenegger to respond on social media with a message for the president, whom he simply called Donald.
Hey, Donald, I have a great idea. Why don't we switch jobs? You take over TV because you're such an expert in ratings, and I take over your job, and then people can finally sleep comfortably again.
That's former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Of course, we'll be talking more about the president's now struck down or temporarily delayed executive order on immigration and refugees. But there's been a lot of criticism that Trump's order was, in essence, a ban based on religion. At the prayer breakfast, Trump says the nation was founded on religion.
But we are all united by our faith in our Creator and our firm knowledge that we are all equal in his eyes. Our republic was formed on the basis that freedom is not a gift from government, but that freedom is a gift from God. I will get rid of and totally destroy the Johnson Amendment and allow our representatives of faith to speak freely and without fear of retribution. I will do that, remember.
So that Johnson Amendment is actually Lyndon Johnson amendment to legislation from the former late president's days in Washington as a congressman, which allowed or was aimed at preventing those kinds of institutions that have tax-exempt status from explicitly supporting political candidates. That's something that, quite frankly, in practice, you don't see enforced all that often, but that's something that the new president has pledged to get rid of. Now, of course, last week we also had the president's reference to abolitionist Frederick Douglass during an event for African History Month. Trump said he was glad that Douglass was getting more attention, and at the daily press briefing, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was asked what the president's reference to Frederick Douglass was all about.
It's about Frederick Douglass being recognized more and more. Do you have any idea what specifically he was referring to?
Well, I think there's contribution. I think he wants to highlight the contributions that he has made. And I think through a lot of the actions and statements that he's going to make, I think the contributions of Frederick Douglass will become more and more.
So Spicer said the statements that he's going to make. Frederick Douglass has been dead since 1895, though that line might make him roll over in his grave. Well, back to that executive order on migrants that the president issued, that the courts have stayed. Some have called it a Muslim ban, but House Speaker Paul Ryan said no, it isn't.
This is not a Muslim ban. If it were, I would be against it. We are a tolerant, pluralistic country. We are and we will be. It's really important. The bill we passed last year, if you recall, after the Paris shooting, it became clear to us that one of the terrorists infiltrated the refugee population coming from Syria. So we wanted to make sure that that didn't happen here in this country. That's just sort of like national security 101. And then when we inquired among our professionals at Homeland Security and the FBI, can you properly vet these people to make sure that this doesn't happen in America? They said, no, we can't. And so that's why we passed legislation with 289 votes, big bipartisan bill, saying let's pause this program until we can figure out how to get it right. That's effectively what this is about.
So Democrats reacting strongly to the order. In court, a government lawyer had said that 100,000 visas had initially been revoked. And if, as I said, if you were at the airport and it was written on that visa that it's been canceled, you still can't use that visa. So even though the order has been stayed, there's still a lot of headaches for those trying to come into the U.S. that have legal visas. As I said, Democrats reacting strongly. Here's Illinois Senior Senator Democrat Dick Durbin.
This decision to indefinitely suspend the admission of Syrian refugees into the United States is not a decision based on fact. Since 9/11, since the war in Syria began, we have not had a single, not one, instance of terrorism by a Syrian refugee. Not one. The United States has not stepped up, as other countries like Canada have, in admitting Syrian refugees. We have gone to great lengths, extraordinary lengths, to give background checks that are as consuming as one can imagine, to verify their identity and their safety to the United States. Overwhelmingly, these Syrian refugees are the victims of a deadly war which has gone on for years, and overwhelmingly, they are children with their mothers. I've met them. I sat down with them in Chicago. It's heartbreaking to think that they lived through war, may have been lucky enough to make it to a refugee camp, and then waited for years, to be cleared by the United States and given a chance to come to this country. It has to be a heartbreaking process.
That's Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin speaking about the issue of immigration, the president's executive order on the Senate floor. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Nice Blackhawks victory last night over the Dallas Stars. They play again on Wednesday, taking on the division-leading Minnesota Wild. We need to make up some ground on those guys. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Todd Meisch. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois State Chamber of Commerce. We'll also be speaking later in the program to Illinois State Comptroller Susana Mendoza and Rebecca Shee, the executive director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Sunday morning, and welcome back to the Sunday Spin. A kind of brisk morning to start Super Bowl Sunday out there, just out on the WGN Storm Center patio. Some breezes blowing in from the northwest, but a bright, sunny morning here on Michigan Avenue, here in the Allstate Showcase Studio and Tribune Tower. You know, last week brought us a lot of talk out of the president's office. He had a convening of African-American supporters, and they included a Cleveland pastor named Daryl Scott, who brought up the issue of Chicago violence.
I was recently contacted by some of the top gang thugs in Chicago for a sit-down.
Scott told President Trump gangs would curb gun violence in exchange for added social programs.
They reached out to me because they associated me with you. They respect you. They believe in what you're doing. And they want to have a sit down about lowering that body count. These are guys straight from the streets, no politicians, straight street guys. But they're going to commit that if they lower that body count, we'll come in and we'll do some social programs.
By afternoon, Scott reversed himself in this phone interview.
I misspoke. Listen, I only had 3 hours sleep at the time. I meant to say former street thugs. Former.
Still, Scott says he and other African-American leaders will soon travel to Chicago to offer assistance. Southside pastor Father Michael Flager, who's battled Chicago gun violence for decades, blasted Reverend Scott.
While we've been fighting this thing for years, where has this pastor been, and why hasn't anybody heard about him?
President Trump seized on Reverend Scott's remarks and, as he so often does, threatened to step in.
If they're not going to solve the problem and what you're doing is the right thing, then we're going to solve the problem for them.
That's WGN's Tamon Bradley's report. And you know, first Scott says he didn't speak to current gang thugs, but just a former gang leader. And then later he said, well, it was a couple of former gang leaders. Kind of a very interesting display of events. Number of Chicago anti-violence leaders saying that the president's commitment for 20 additional ATF agents doesn't really help get into some of the root causes of violence here in the city. Well, joining me now on the phone is Todd Meisch. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce. And Todd, thanks for joining me this morning.
Great to be with you this morning. Thanks, Rick.
And I'm glad to have you here because obviously we have the Illinois legislature coming back into session this week. Growing talk about the fate of what some have dubbed the, quote, grand bargain, unquote. Some have dubbed. I'm not so sure I'd go there yet. But certainly this evolving kind of compromise package that the Senate President, Democrat John Cullerton, Republican leader Christine Rodonio have been working on. And I know in the past there were hearings on, as I said, the still evolving package, but the chamber has been pretty outspoken in opposition to the entire package. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, first of all, I'd say we give an awful lot of credit to Leader Rodonio and President Cullerton for getting together and trying to move the ball forward. We recognize that you've got to have discussions in order to reach a final resolution to this problem. However, at the same time, we've got to be able to tell our members and the public what's really on paper at this point in time. So the Senate introduced 13 pieces of legislation on the first day of the new General Assembly, and the problem is that those 13 pieces of legislation, they're all linked, they are all one package, and it's a net negative for the Illinois economy the way it exists right now. We're in discussions to try and improve that. I think you'll see a better product come out even this week, but as it stands right now, those 13 bills are a net negative for the Illinois economy, for Illinois employers, and we're opposed as they're written now.
Well, Todd, when I was down there for the governor's State of the State message, and this was kind of simultaneous with the Senate kind of doing a lot of hurrying up and waiting activity, as is so often the case on major legislation. But it seemed apparent, at least from the Senate Republican rank and file, that there was a concern that business wasn't getting enough in return for what they were being asked.
I would say that that's a big part of our calculus in opposing the package as it exists. Right now, you're talking about what upward of $6 billion in higher taxes, both on individuals and on businesses, and particularly onerous taxes that we just think weren't, you know, perhaps thoroughly vetted before they were included. Literally, there is a tax on jobs included in the package now. There's a new tax on services. We think that those are really problematic. And at the end of the day, again, we give Cullerton and Rodonio a lot of credit for moving the ball, but the changes to our jobs climate in Illinois are not strong enough. Workers' comp is, I think everybody knows, at the top of the list of things we'd like to see and gets an awful lot of attention. The bill as it exists now is simply not a real cost savings to businesses. And then there are other things that we'd like to see, such as assistance to small businesses, recognizing that they create the majority of jobs in Illinois and in the nation, and we ought to do something to nurture their growth. We'd like to see that in a package, too.
Todd, maybe you could explain that tax that's being talked about as far as jobs. And I don't know who came up with the idea of naming it an opportunity tax. I'm not so sure that those two words go together in the same sentence. But maybe you could explain what that tax is and why you're opposed.
Yeah, I think everybody recognizes that was an unfortunate oversight on somebody's standpoint to call a tax on jobs an opportunity tax. So really what it is a flat kind of fee that grows if you get larger. But when you look at the tax, and we've analyzed it, if you have $3 million of sales, and again, it's pretty easy to get to $3 million in sales, you pay 75% of the overall tax. So businesses that have $3 million in sales and less are paying 75% of a $750 million tab. We think that that is just absolutely the wrong policy. I think we're making real headway in convincing members on both sides of the aisle that that was an idea, but an idea that should be quickly shelved. And I'm hoping that we'll see legislation this week that shelves permanently that idea and it goes away.
Well, it's my understanding that this was kind of a trade-off in exchange for getting rid of what's known as the franchise tax.
We have heard that as well. We were not in the room when that discussion was taking place, but I will tell you that, yes, we've heard that connection as well. And again, the real problem here is that you've got a package that is also, not only is it gigantic in its size, it's completely out of balance when it comes to benefits for to small businesses. Franchise tax is a complicated tax, but it's a tax that large corporations pay. Small, medium-sized businesses largely do not pay that tax. So if you're getting rid of the franchise tax, which we think should go away, it's antiquated and it should be shelved. But the problem is you're paying for that revenue by taxing small, medium-sized businesses who get no savings from repeal of the franchise tax. Again, we've just missed the target there badly, and that needs to be corrected.
Todd, is this? Let's just step back away from this, and as you start out by saying, you know, it's 13 pieces of legislation, everything from raising the Illinois income tax to dealing with changes in workers' compensation. Each bill is linked. Every bill has to pass, or they all fail. Is this just too much, too quick, too soon, and too big to be able to be accomplished in a thoughtful way?
I will tell you that we have shared our opinion that they, you know, it's a difficult problem, or else we wouldn't have been going 2 years without a budget. So again, Leader Redonio and her caucus, and Senator Cullerton and her
It's good that they're talking.
It really is. But at the same time, we've got to respond to what is in front of us. And we have shared our position that, you know what, 13 bills sounds like an awful lot of things to get done. Now, there are arguments for doing so. There's a reason for each one of those 13 bills to be on the table. There's something that the governor has asked for. There are priorities in one caucus or another. But we have suggested that, you know what, 13 bills is an awful lot to try and get done. It really ought to be four or five, and zero in on the most important things, get some pro-growth ideas out there, restrain spending to a sustainable level, and then we can talk about revenues that we can you know, hopefully maintain in a stable way for years to come.
You know, Todd, you've been around this process a long time like I have, and one of the things that I think is a difficult, I mean, there's several difficult political votes involved in this calculus, but to cast a vote for any kind of a tax increase or new tax on business and not have any kind of a budget bill that you can also hold up and say, yeah, we did this, but here's where we cut spending. It's like the cuts are yet to be determined, and you know, that's the bet that no one can see. And it seems very hard to be able to cast, you know, a vote to raise taxes and then not be able to show some kind of concurrent cut in spending.
I would concur. I will tell you, over the last few days that I talked to members on both sides of the aisle, that is increasingly becoming the number one issue. Yes, there is a discussion about revenues, but there doesn't seem to be a balanced approach to spending. So I will tell you, though, that there are thoughtful people who are really trying to strategize on that issue, that want to have spending restraints, and they do have a plan for a spending cap. The problem is nobody really knows exactly how that's going to work, where that cap comes into play. It seems to be very high, baking in current levels of spending that are not sustainable. So, again, there are thoughtful people that are really trying their best to address the spending side. It doesn't seem to be baked to me at this point, though.
We're speaking with Todd Meisch. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Yeah. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson, and this is your Sunday Spin. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. And joining me on the phone is Todd Meisch. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce. And we've been talking about the efforts by Republicans and Democrats in the Illinois State Senate to end the now 19-month budget impasse in Springfield with a large, large compromise package of legislation. And the chamber, as it stands, is opposed to that package as it exists. It's still evolving. And when lawmakers come back to Springfield later this week, I'm sure we're going to see several new iterations. Todd, one of the other things I wondered, too, in the past when we've kind of seen a major tax legislation, We've also traditionally coupled that with a capital bill, a public improvements bill, something we haven't had in a while. Obviously, I think everybody agrees about the need to keep, maintain, and build new infrastructure in this state. And there again, that's one of those where you have lawmakers that can say, okay, I cast the politically difficult vote to raise taxes, but you know, here's one of those projects that I can point to, a new overpass or something, just to say, you know, at least we're getting some bang for our buck.
Yeah, I do think that that is one big, again, error of omission here. It's, we're not talking about capital right now. I do believe there's strong consensus from the governor and all four caucuses that we really, really need a capital and transportation investment bill. The difference of opinion has been whether it's too difficult to get it done at the same time as a budget resolution. I would contend that currently in the Senate envisioned as a solution to the budget problem, but also we're going to change education funding. I'm saying if you think you can do a very intractable solution to the budget and you think you're going to do education funding, which has vexed policymakers for more than 20 years.
Keep going. How about 30?
Yeah. So we think that that is a piece that is missing, and we are hopeful that the political calculus of decision makers comes around to see that, you know what, a capital vote makes it easier to solve the budget rather than more complex.
I mean, it's part of moving the state forward.
Yeah, I mean, infrastructure is so important to Illinois. It's important to every state, but probably no more Illinois is more important than perhaps any other state in the nation when you look at our assets and our location. And the things that are succeeding in our economy are so heavily weighted towards parts of the economy that are infrastructure and transportation dependent. It's a no-brainer in my mind that we've got to go ahead and get infrastructure on the top line of things to do along with a budget resolution.
Todd, we've talked a lot about revenue taxation issues, that kind of thing. But, I mean, there's certainly a number of wants as far as business changes that are part of this package as well, probably none more so than workers' compensation. Is that still an evolving topic?
It is still evolving. We're having discussions, again, with all sorts of legislators about what those changes should be. We've always said that, you know what, all we're looking to do is get Illinois back in the mainstream of workers' compensation costs. We don't need to be the cheapest system in the nation, but we need to be in the middle of the pack. And we've got some very reasonable proposals, we think, that just get us from being a cost outlier to businesses to being one that's being a state that's in the middle of the pack. The biggest thing that gets an awful lot of talk about is, you know, what is the threshold for determining whether an injury has really happened in the workplace or it just happened over the natural course of life or outside the workplace. We think that's the single biggest change you can make is say that, you know what, if the workplace contributes even 1% to somebody's injury, it's automatically a workers' comp case, and that workers' comp case is very, very expensive in Illinois, and we think that's the most important thing to get done. We'll see if that argument carries the day.
That's the term causation that gets thrown around.
Causation, to be honest, that term's a little bruised, I guess. So we prefer to say, what's the threshold for determining whether a injury happened in the workplace or did not happen in the workplace? It's the same issue.
What are you hearing from lawmakers over in the House chamber about what the Senate's doing? Because again, you know, here another hurdle is, how willing are senators on either side to vote for something if whatever they might do never sees the light of day in the House?
That's a great point. That is a great point. We recognize and support the effort to try and get the ball rolling in the Senate. There are no guarantees that whatever the Senate comes up with is going to ever see the light of day in the House. So that is a real concern, and it makes an incredibly complex issue, even more so, both on policy and the politics side. I think that the House has been pretty quiet.
Very, very quiet.
And I think that that is not a positive if you're looking for a quick resolution, in my opinion.
The governor came to the Chicago Tribune editorial board last week and talked about his upcoming state budget address and basically alluded to the fact that it's going to be the same format that he presented last year that was rejected by the Democratic legislature of either, you know, work with me and fashion out a budget or give me the authority, even further authority than he has, to just go ahead and make cuts. So, I mean, it seems like we might have a glint of progress on one side of this equation, but we're kind of back to square one on the other side on, as far as spending.
Yeah, I don't know. The governor doesn't have a lot of good options at this point in time. I think he is correctly encouraging discussions in the Senate, and that's, I think, a very appropriate and right thing to do. I do think that he deserves some credit, though, for standing up and saying if the legislature cannot give, cannot come to the table and fashion a solution with me, then give me the authority to get this done myself. I think that that is a message that voters get. And that's one where I think the Democrats in the legislature have a little exposure, which is hey, if you're not going to get the job done, you've got a governor stepping up saying, I'll get it done for us all. And if you don't give him that opportunity, you're taking him up on that offer. That's a little more political exposure than I think a lot of Democratic legislators would expect.
So, in the end, how optimistic are you that we're going to get anywhere before the 2018 election?
Well, I don't want to say anything that that undercuts what everybody wants, which is a comprehensive solution. Again, from the chamber standpoint, it means pro-growth policies, it means spending restraint, and then a discussion about appropriate levels of revenue. So we don't want to undercut that. But I will tell you that over the last 23 years I've been around, betting on something a little less than optimal is usually a pretty safe bet. So there, we're not going to go back to the point where we have no budget for months and months on end. Certainly we don't have one now. There will be some kind of resolution. I think we all hope for a comprehensive solution. But if it's short of that, I would not be surprised.
Do you think that the possibility of state workers not getting paid might be a motivating factor?
That is certainly a potential game changer. And I will be honest, I can't tell you which party is going to be more upended by that state of affairs, if indeed it does happen. It is not a foregone conclusion, I understand. There are legal remedies that the governor is going to pursue. There are political remedies that people are going to pursue as well. So I'm not going on the assumption that's a foregone conclusion that state workers aren't going to be paid after the 28th. I think it may be drawn out, or the judge can always just tell the attorney general that thanks for your opinion, but I disagree, and the current state of affairs continues. The strike vote I'm more interested in. AFSCME is currently going to ballot. We will see if they are going to muster a majority that allows a strike vote or allows a strike. That's, I think, more immediate and more interesting to me as we speak today.
And more political ramifications involved in that.
Yes, no doubt about it. I think that that is, I believe that the state is well prepared to handle a strike. I don't want to insert myself too much. The chamber is probably not the best organization to help facilitate that discussion, to be honest. But I'll be very fascinated to watch the outcome of that vote and what happens next.
Todd, one last thing I wanted to ask you about. I know that you are part of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition, and Rebecca Shee, the executive director, will be joining the show later. But I'm just wondering about, in light of all of this recent flurry of activity involving the president's executive order and what we saw a week ago in the airports, now it's in the courts. But just about, this doesn't get us anywhere closer to any kind of comprehensive immigration reform that, you know, everybody was optimistic about 3 years ago.
Yeah. I do think it's certainly problematic. There are elements that, I think the business community would actually support, making sure that we've got safe borders and we know who's coming in. But the notion you had people stranded at airports and important employees not being able to get back to their jobs, that was clearly implemented very, very poorly and was not well thought out. So we certainly hope that those issues get addressed. But in terms of whether it pushes things forward or not, I think in a almost perverse way, it does make the case that this piecemeal and kind of reactive approach to immigration does not work well at all, and that we've got to get back to having a comprehensive approach to it. That's what we are for at the Chamber, with a lot of like-minded employers. Immigration is incredibly important to the Illinois economy. We'll just have to see. We're working hard with individual legislators to win them over to a comprehensive approach, and I'm cautiously optimistic. Rebecca does great work at IBIC, and she's well-positioned to, help us, Illinois, be a leader for comprehensive immigration reform.
That's Todd Meisch. He's president and CEO of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce. Todd, thanks so much for getting up with me this morning.
No, it was great. I enjoyed it very much.
You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the second hour of your Sunday Spin on this sunny Super Bowl Sunday in downtown Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, and I'm joined by Illinois Democratic Comptroller Susana Mendoza. And frankly, Comptroller, it's my first chance to see you in quite a while, and since your victory in November and your inauguration, welcome to the studio this morning.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Before we begin, I want to, I mentioned earlier in the program that Governor Rauner was appeared before the Chicago Tribune's editorial board last week, where he discussed a variety of things. And one of those I asked him about was a letter sent at the end of last month to your legal counsel. This was the governor's general counsel, over the issue of Attorney General Lisa Madigan's effort in St. Clair County Circuit Court. There's a court order that requires state employees to be paid. And Lisa Madigan, in her filing, says that a Supreme Court decision clarified that the Constitution requires that there has to be a specific budget appropriation for employees to get paid. And so she has gone to the St. Clair County Court, basically trying to get a February 28th, end of the month, deadline on whether employees can be paid. The governor's office saying that they have concerns that this could precipitate a crisis, and they asked that you continue to pay state employees regardless of any actions from the court. Here's Governor Rauner when I asked him about this.
If the order gets lifted, then she's in a position to decide whether to pay people or not.
Well, by virtue of that judge's, if the judge lifts it, by virtue of the Supreme Court decision,
then she could decide herself whether to pay or not. Yes, and I'm encouraging her to decide to pay, for sure.
But that would appear to be a violation of the state constitution.
No, I don't agree. My lawyers wouldn't agree to that.
So that's the governor's interpretation. I mean, my question was, you like every statewide elected official, like every member of the General Assembly, is sworn to uphold the state constitution. And while I think everyone agrees no one wants to see state workers getting caught in the political football of this lengthy budget impasse, what happens if the St. Clair County judge lifts that order?
So it's really clear I would be in violation of the law if I continued to pay. And, you know, the governor, I think, has a habit of not paying attention to the state constitution. And for him to not, I'm not going to say like actually he did. He basically went out of his way to put this on me, to somehow deflect to me and to ask me, basically demand that I break the law. And that's not going to happen. I mean, like, he's not above the law. I'm not above the law. The law is the law. It's very clear. And I'm going to adhere to it at every step of the way.
Now, of course, we're speaking in a speculative sense because we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what the judge could ultimately, you know, adjust some kind of a ruling, extend a time period, things like that. Sure. But it would seem from that 2015 Supreme Court decision that it's pretty clear that the Constitution is very plain in its language about you have to have an appropriation passed by the legislature and signed into law to make these payments.
That's correct. And my job is going to be to, you know, adhere to the Constitution and to follow whatever court ruling happens. So I'm going to abide by the law.
What are your feelings about the fact that the Attorney General decided to enter the fray now? And, of course, we've heard all kinds of speculation. She actually wrote a piece in the State Journal Register in Springfield explaining her rationale behind it and had hoped that the six-month stopgap budget and post-election would be enough to start forging some kind of compromise, but ultimately decided that the fact that state employees get paid has prevented a compromise rather than enhanced the opportunity for one.
Right. The concept that the governor is saying that the Attorney General is trying to create a crisis is just so, it's sad and it's laughable at the same time, because if he thinks that she's trying to create a crisis, it just shows a disconnect from reality that we are in the worst fiscal crisis that our state has ever been in. I, as the Illinois Comptroller, see this more so than anybody up close and personal. It really can't get that much worse. Your average person may not be feeling the reality of how bad this crisis is because, in fact, if you need to go get your driver's license, you can, right? The facility is still open. If you need state police, they're available. They're still around, right? So I think the Attorney General is saying without an appropriation, the state constitution is clear that we cannot be making these payments, and we're, you know, with the Supreme Court case, clearly in violation. So I don't know if that's true. That's what a judge will determine. I think the fact that the governor is trying to deflect blame from where it really lies, and I believe it lies with the fact that he has not adhered to his constitutional duty, which is very clear. It's not my opinion. It's not a Democratic or a Republican thing. It's what the state constitution clearly says in Article 8, Section 2, that the governor shall prepare and submit to the General Assembly a balanced budget proposal. That's what it says. It says the governor shall prepare it, not maybe should think about it or, you know, should prepare. It says the governor shall prepare. There's no wiggle room in shall. And it says to the General Assembly is who he has to present it to, not the other way around. So look, if the Constitution said in Article 8, Section 2, that the Illinois General Assembly shall prepare and submit to the governor for his consideration a balanced budget proposal, then I would be harping on the General Assembly to do their job. But the Constitution is very clear, and it clearly says that the governor shall prepare and submit to the General Assembly for their action a balanced budget proposal. We are now going into a third year without that balanced budget proposal. He hasn't done it once. He hasn't done it twice. And as a result of that, my office is responsible for having to pay $11.2 billion in bill backlogs, right? That's how bad of a situation we're in. We've had six downgrades to our credit since Governor Rauner has taken office. Our state has never been worse off financially, yet this governor's personal finances have more than tripled since he was sworn in. I mean, you have to acknowledge that there's a massive disconnect between the reality that he's living in and the reality of your average person in the state of Illinois. And so, you know, I look at my role as this opportunity to really tell the story of what's happening in this state and to try to deflect blame from where it should be, which is with him, right? He's like the quarterback of the team. I mean, tonight's the Super Bowl, right? You're looking at Tom Brady or whoever the quarterbacks are. What's the job of the quarterback? It's to get the ball, which in this case would be a budget proposal, and launch it, throw it to his receivers. You know, let's look at that as the General Assembly so that they can then take it into the end zone and score a touchdown, right? Equivalent to passing a budget. Now, if the quarterback isn't doing his job, what happens? He gets sacked or he gets replaced. And I really think that that's kind of like a good analogy for what we're living in the state of Illinois right now. Our quarterback is just not doing his job. He's not leading the team. And he's putting all of the blame on the legislature as if it's their job per the Constitution. It's not. I mean, really, just pull the Constitution, read it. You'll see that this is your job. And also, take time to read the Constitution, the part that says that I am not allowed to pay without an appropriation, so that you know, this does not become an issue of like, oh, Controller Mendoza, it's her fault if the state goes into crisis, or it's the attorney general's fault. It's like, enough of the blame game, enough of the deflection, take some responsibility, lead the state. You're now going into your third year. You're not a rookie to this anymore. You can't call yourself an outsider. It's as insider as you get, and it's time for him to do his job.
Now, I will say, during his editorial board appearance, he maintained that he did present balanced budgets in his budget proposals.
As you know, that's just not true. That is clearly an alternative fact. He did not at any point present a balanced budget proposal. He presented, in his mind, what were balanced budget proposals based on situations for revenue that he knew were never actually going to happen. For example, the pension reform, which was found to be unconstitutional. And so you can't predicate, and the actual Constitution says that, a budget proposal based on, revenue that does not exist, right? So the governor would have to, during his budget proposal, present a budget plan that clearly shows how we're going to pay for things. In other words, revenue, what revenue is going to be out there, whether it's, you know, through his tax increases or whatever you want to call it. And also, those expenditures that we make as a state cannot exceed the revenues that are coming into this state. So one of his other budget proposals, which is probably, it sounds like, based on that Tribune editorial board meeting that he's going to present in next month, or this month, I should say, sounds like the same thing he did last year, which is, you know, wanting authority from the General Assembly to be able to veto every single line item that he wants to do. Again, he's putting his job in the hands of the General Assembly. Part of doing a budget proposal is to, as the governor, lay out what your priorities are. So it's not the legislature's job to give you a full veto authority. You have that when you're actually writing up your budget proposal. You can say right now what it is that you think should be cut and cut that in your budget proposal. You can say right now where you think the revenue should be coming from and put those into your budget proposal. And that's what a budget proposal is all about. It's nobody else's job but his to actually do the proposal, because according to Article 8, Section 2 of the Constitution of Illinois, it says that the governor shall prepare and submit to the General Assembly a balanced budget proposal. Then it goes to the General Assembly, and these guys actually have to get to work on trying to pass that budget. So they have a responsibility, too. But it's kind of like the alphabet. It goes in order, A, B, C, D, etc. A is the governor actually preparing and submitting a balanced budget proposal. B is then the legislature taking action on that balanced budget proposal, working with him on the things that they agree with or don't agree with, coming to compromise, negotiating. That's where you negotiate and compromise. And then actually putting it up for a vote, passing it, and getting our state back on the right track. I would like to be able to, as C, do my job of do my job of paying the state's bills on time. That would be like an amazing thing to be able to do. The treasurer of the state of Illinois, who's got a really difficult job right now, we're losing millions of dollars because he can't be investing the state's funds in long-term vehicles. Why? Because we need the liquidity to be able to, on a day-to-day basis, triage the situation of paying for hospice care or the most vulnerable in this state. He would, I'm sure, like to be able to invest more money in different vehicles that would bring millions of dollars in interest gains to or dividends to the state of Illinois. That can't happen as long as there is no budget proposal that the legislature can then sink their teeth into trying to pass. And I think that's what the average person out there doesn't know. They blame everything on the legislature because the governor's done a great job and spent millions of dollars in trying to frame that narrative. But don't take my opinion for it. Seriously, just Google the Illinois State Constitution, read Section 8, Article 8, Section 2, and you're going to see that it clearly says that the governor shall prepare and present a balanced budget proposal to the General Assembly, and then they're supposed to get to work.
We're speaking with Illinois State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue, joined by Susana Mendoza, Democrat from Chicago, Illinois State Comptroller. Madam Comptroller, on Friday, Governor Rauner unveiled a new member of his administrative team, a familiar name perhaps, certainly to you. He named as deputy governor looks like a new position. We have had deputy governors in the past, but named your predecessor, his appointee as comptroller, Leslie Munger, to that job. I'm curious what you think of the fiscal, if not political, implications of that.
Well, let me just start by saying that I wish her well, and I hope her very first job assignment is to sit down with the governor and figure out a way for him to abide by his constitutional duty of presenting, you know, preparing and submitting a balanced budget proposal to the General Assembly so we can get to work. So first and foremost, having said that, you think about the fact that, as far as I know, we have already like four governor-related titles, at least, right? So we got two deputy governors, a lieutenant governor, and a governor, and we still have no budget. So really, at the end of the day, that's what this is about for me. Nothing can improve in this state without a budget. I don't know why we'd need four governor titles to make that happen. It still hasn't happened. But it is what it is. So I think being fiscally prudent has not been the hallmark of this administration. It's part of the reason why we're in the situation that we are, which is dire and, in fact, a crisis.
I mentioned earlier on the prospect of having to get up every morning and look at this backlog of bills owed to vendors and just the time span, too, of what it takes for some of these vendors to get paid. How does it work? How do you determine what discretionary authority do you have to determine how the bills get paid?
Right. So, like, if all things were great, it would be an easy job where you just, you know, as you get a bill, you pay it, right? That would be the ideal situation. But when you're looking at $11.2 billion in a bill backlog, it's impossible to do that. So we are looking at trying to prioritize the most vulnerable. That's why on the very first day that I took office, I moved all employee bonuses to the back of the line. We're going to be prioritizing social service providers and people who are in dire need of funding. Otherwise, they'll close their doors before we give bonuses to state employees. You might recall during my election, the governor and through the controller went ahead and approved $4 million in bonuses to state employees in the eve of the election. And that was unconscionable when you're considering that seniors are going hungry without their meals and wheels and students are dropping out of college because they're not getting their MAP grant funding and small businesses aren't getting the small business development money that they need. So now my predecessor said it was impossible to differentiate between base pay and bonus pay. And I argued contrary to that. And on my very first day in office, I got my team together and I said, hey, we're going to make this happen. And on day three, we actually gave the order to all of the state agencies that moving forward, all of the vouchers that they submit to me for payment have to be delineated, whether it's base pay or bonus pay. And we've moved bonus pay to the back of the line. And so it's all about prioritizing in times of fiscal crisis who we have to pay first. And it's not an easy job. It's an incredibly difficult job. If you think about the fact that this $11.2 billion budget backlog, I think the number is just so abstract. It's hard for people to even understand what that means. But they're more than just numbers on a spreadsheet. This is a situation that tells a story about thousands of people in the state of Illinois that are suffering. Just last week, I got an email from a woman who's a professor at the university, I should say at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to be traveling to Carbondale next week to meet with her. I'm really trying to go out of my way to be a controller that listens, that tries to understand this issue so that I can then tell the story about what this budget impasse means. What's the cost in human capital of an $11.2 billion deficit right now? And so this woman needed specialty medical care and had to go to St. Louis to get it because it was specialized. And she had an appointment. There was a terrible ice storm in Southern Illinois a few weeks ago. The roads were closed. She had to cancel the appointment. When she called to reschedule her appointment, she was told that they're no longer taking any employees with state insurance or people who actually even reside in Illinois. And so she now has to go without the specialized medical care or try to find it elsewhere. And it just complicates her life even more. And she believes, like, how is this even legal? I pay into my insurance fully. And now I'm being told that because I live in Illinois, because of this budget impasse, they're not going to give me the medical care that I need. And these are stories that I hear every day. I think that I have a responsibility as a new controller to advocate for people and to actually tell their stories in a way that people can connect with. They understand that this is not just a number on a spreadsheet. $11.2 billion represents people who are going without. Let me tell you what else it represents. It represents almost $700 million that we will never be investing in people, if not upwards of $700 million. And what we could buy with that, I kind of want to run this by you. Business is important. We should be investing in small business growth. We could spend $5 million on that. Domestic violence intervention and prevention, we could fund that to the tune of $49 million. Home-delivered meals for seniors, it might be the only meal they get and their only point of contact with humans that day, $13 million. Home health care, $15 million. Hospice care for the absolutely most vulnerable people in this state, we could fund that at $77 million. And early intervention programs for children with disabilities or just children who need an additional help getting started on the right foot at $85 million. MAP grants for our students. If any of us have kids in college or know kids that are dropping out of school because they're not getting their MAP grants, we could fund that at $430 million. That alone, $674 million in wasted human opportunity is what we're looking at. And we can still fund more just with the interest payments on the $11.2 billion that we owe people.
That's what that $700 million
represents late payments or late penalty penalty for making our payments late, right? It's interest payments on these late fees. And so every time that we go without paying a bill on time, we're incurring a 12% penalty on that. It is criminal. So forget about the fact that we're just 11, I should say not just, but we clearly have $11.2 billion of backlog. Besides the fact that we owe all that money and people aren't getting paid and businesses are closing or social service providers are closing their doors and unable to help people, there's also this late payment cost that is running to the tune of almost $1 billion. And again, that's money that we'll never be able to invest in people. It is so fiscally irresponsible. It's such a dereliction of duty that this needs to stop. And I feel that it is really my obligation as the Illinois Comptroller of the State's Chief Fiscal Officer to talk about how the fact that we are now going into a third year without a budget because this governor is just so married to his pet projects is really costing the state in a very significant way. And I have yet to meet a single business owner who tells me that they will either come to Illinois if we pass term limits or leave Illinois unless if we pass term limits. Business owners, what they want to know is, are they going to be able to make their payroll? Can they plan for the future growth of their business? That is not what's happening today. We are bleeding out jobs, even with a lower tax rate. When they let the tax rate expire, we haven't seen any job creation because of that. So this concept that businesses are only leaving because of taxes is absurd. They're leaving in large part because we are going into a third year without a budget. And the governor, who is supposedly, you know, a great business mind, has clearly failed the state when it comes to helping businesses and creating jobs in this state. I guess he just created one on Friday, right? But that might be the only job that I've seen him create since he's been governor.
That's Illinois Democratic Comptroller, Illinois' Susana Mendoza, Democrat from Chicago. Madam Comptroller, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, Rebecca Sheehy. She's the Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. A very, very busy week that we're recapping, and the week that never ends because overnight, of course, we had the Ninth Appellate U.S. Court rejecting the Trump administration's Justice Department request for an emergency order to reimpose the president's executive order on immigration and refugees. I wanted to play this cut of the Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. He spoke with CNN's Anderson Cooper after a federal judge in Seattle struck down the president's initial executive order.
Things have to be done in accordance with our Constitution. That is the bottom line, and is central to who we are as a people. And the president simply did not meet that obligation, which is central to his responsibilities, and one, to be crystal clear, as we wrap up, I will hold him to throughout his administration, frankly, in the same way that I filed two lawsuits against the Obama administration when I felt they were acting in an unlawful fashion, and we prevailed in the first and are litigating the second. That's my duty and my responsibility as a lawyer and as Attorney General for the people of this state.
That's the Washington State Attorney General, Bob Ferguson. Joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase Studios, a good friend of the program, Rebecca Shee. Rebecca is the Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. And Rebecca, you part of this multi-pronged business effort over the years to try to gain some kind of comprehensive immigration reform, something that at one time looked very achievable when the Gang of Eight in the U.S. Senate bipartisanly put forth a proposal, now a proposal that many have walked away from. Then you have the Trump election that was, from the outset, kind of predicated on the issue of immigration. And you see what we've come to know as really kind of turmoil that exists. How is the coalition responding to all of this?
Thank you so much for having me again, Rick. Good morning. I think as you mentioned, our coalition with bipartisan business leaders came together to really try to address the root causes of our broken immigration system. And our employers from the high-skilled and low-skilled ends have seen over the years the ways in which our system hasn't allowed our business to grow, entrepreneurs to create more jobs, and in the end, growing our economy and the workforce. And so we've seen in Illinois and also across the country, business leaders who are Republicans and Democrats have coming together to say, hey, you know, we have to do something to repair the system. And to your clip earlier, I think what we saw with this travel ban is that it, instead of moving closer to addressing the workforce or even safety, as the ban predicated to do, it actually further disrupted the workforce. For example, one of our companies reported that they had an engineer who works in Chicago, and the work that he does, you know, makes possible about 12 U.S. citizens work here. And he was stuck in Nairobi for about three days because his passport originally was from Somalia, but he hasn't lived there for about 15 years. You know, his home is Chicago. He has U.S. citizen children. He has a green card. He's a legal permanent resident. And so, you know, for those days of uncertainty and chaos, you know, he was concerned. His family was incredibly fearful. And of course, the future of the business was in limbo as well. And I think that that being an example of, we all want safety, we all want security, but it's also important to really get at the root causes of these issues rather than, as our chairman, John Rowe, says, you know, trying to kill wasps with a sledgehammer. That just doesn't work and doesn't make any economic or security sense.
Well, I was going to point out, and John Rowe, chairman emeritus of Exelon, and co-chairman of the Business Immigration Coalition, wrote a piece in Cranes and said that to him personally, that these orders were imprecisely conceived and poorly executed. Mm-hmm. And as far as the executed point of it, I think what seemed to be very concerning was the issue of people who had valid visas going to the airport and basically having written on them that visa is canceled by virtue of this, when, I mean, they were legal. And the effect, you know, and maybe you can explain like what an H-1B visa is and how that's kind of what's helping drive technology and highly skilled companies in the United States.
Sure. I mean, so we saw over this last week companies like Google, like Amazon, Facebook, these high-skill, high-tech giants that are the engines of our economy coming out in very strong terms and a very united voice against these bans because, to your point, right, the drivers of their company are these high-skilled engineers and web designers, and many of them were immigrants or children of immigrants. And, you know, many of them, to your point, are legal and have H-1 visas or even green cards that were included in these bans. And so I think for the business community, I think everybody agrees and support more security, better verification at our airports. But the facts are, you know, and this was a study that the Cato Institute actually came out, the day of or the day after the ban, showing that, you know, the chances of a refugee committing an act of terrorism in the United States is 1 in 3.6 billion. The chances of an undocumented immigrant committing one of these attacks, according to the Cato Institute, is 1 in nearly 10 billion. And of those seven countries that President-elect Trump listed in
President
his,
Trump.
Oh, sorry. President Trump listed in his bans. If you look at those seven countries, they constitute a very small number of people who committed attacks in the United States since 9/11. The Wall Street Journal had a great survey that showed there was 180 acts of terrorism in the United States, and those countries constituted about 11 to 12 of those attacks. And when compared to other countries, these nine countries actually have a lower instance of attacks than, you know, than countries not listed on the ban. So, I mean, that's all to say that we, you know, believe in improved security. We all would like to have a safer community. But let's figure out how to do that in a more precise and effective way, rather than what has happened.
Well, we kind of saw some of this initially with the issue of whether Syrian refugees should be allowed in. And even Governor Rauner said he supported a pause while trying to ensure that the vetting process was rigorous enough. And actually, he said that the Obama administration did not communicate to the states how they do that vetting process. But we do know it is a lengthy vetting process.
No, absolutely. You know, in compared to other countries like Germany and you know, the United States, as a percentage of our population, receives very few, you know, 10 times less than countries like Germany and others. And that is in large part due to our very rigorous vetting process, and both applying for refugee status and applying for asylum status. And in addition to that, you know, to your point earlier about people who hold H-1s or people who hold green cards, that vetting process is also very rigorous. I mean, I remember even when my father and I were in our process of getting a green card, and my father traveled a lot for the company Novartis, a pharmaceutical, and he was a doctor, so he traveled around the world for clinical trials. I mean, it took him years and years to even get to a response from the Immigration Bureau, because they vetted every time he traveled abroad and see what he was doing, and then would bring him in for questioning. So, you know, it was very, very thorough. And, you know, in the end, we were able to get our green cards, but we, you know, we saw personally just the whole vetting process and fingerprinting, registering with the government, biometrics, and then waiting, you know, a long time for those results, and then going back and forth. So
we're speaking with Rebecca Shee, the executive director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin on this Super Bowl Sunday morning. We're speaking with Rebecca Shee, executive director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition, a good friend of the program. And we're talking, of course, about the activities over this recent days over the issue of President Trump's executive order, order that was held in abeyance by a federal court judge in Seattle. And overnight, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, refusing the Trump administration's Justice Department request for an emergency stay of that judge's order. So things are, quote, back as they were before the president's executive order, although to note that people who had gone to the airport with visas and had customs right canceled on them, those visas aren't any good. Mm-hmm. They have to reapply, mm-hmm. which is its own new set of factors. Mm-hmm. But that visas, green card holders are supposed to be allowed to travel, and that Homeland Security has lifted any of the restrictions. You know, this just... we got a call from a caller, and sorry, we don't have time to take the call, but the caller noted that the seven countries that were named mm-hmm. kind of in an indefinite ban mm-hmm. are countries in anarchy. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe it's a two-way street question. Mm-hmm. When it, I mean, fear, but also these are, in many cases, people feeling oppressed.
No, absolutely. I think that is a good point. I think the about the two-way street is the people who are from these countries that are in turmoil, they're coming, and when they do get the visas, they're heavily vetted, you know, through a very rigorous process, get their biometrics, background check, their fingerprinted, and if they pass, which, you know, if we look at the statistics of the United States receiving and accepting refugee and asylums are very low, and in the event that they do pass muster, they're here not to bring the anarchy, not to bring the turmoil from their countries, but to escape from it and then to create a better life for their children and for their families here. I mean, there were stories both, you know, in you know, Rick's paper, the Chicago Tribune, and around the country, just showing these personal stories of families that have waited for years and years and are bringing their children over to be reunited with spouses that are here. And they've waited patiently to go through this very, you know, rigorous vetting and security process, screening process. And when they finally, you know, get here, right, they're here to work hard to create jobs and to build a life like generations of immigrants have come to this country. So
I guess I wonder if with what we're seeing, if and I talked to Todd Meisch about this from the Illinois Chamber, about the whole issue of whether even if it's fruitful to even talk about any kind of comprehensive immigration reform because of just how polarized things are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so I think that right now we are trying to respond and address some of these executive orders that are being issued and very quickly, right, in the last 2 weeks. So there's this, the ban of nationals from the seven mostly Muslim countries. And then a couple of days before that, President Trump also issued executive orders around, you know, prioritization for enforcement and deportations. And so, and something that we've been pushing very hard as the business coalition is to pass the Bridge Act, which will legislate and replace DACA, the President Obama's executive order for the young undocumented immigrants who are in this country. So we like, this is the legislation that we've seen in Congress and that has bipartisan support for every Democrat who has signed on to be a co-sponsor. There is a Republican. And so right now we have six and six on each side. And you know, Senator Durbin is the sponsor on the Democratic side in the Senate. Lindsey Graham from South Carolina is a Republican from the Senate, and locally Congressman Gutierrez in the House with Republican Congressman Mike Kaufman from Colorado. So this is something, it's not comprehensive. It's one piece of this larger, you know, immigration system that we have to fix. But at least this is something that has bipartisanship. We're working very hard to build more. And the idea is that, you know, there's 750,000 of these young undocumented people who right now have a work permit. They have protection from deportations. They're working, you know, locally in Chicago. They're working in Exelon. They're working in Motorola. They're working in Deloitte. And, you know, they're paying taxes. Some of them are homeowners. And the idea is let's put this in legislation so that they can continue to contribute, continue to, you know, build their lives here and build, you know, the vibrancy of Chicago and Illinois. And so that's, you know, one example of, you know, if we can't get this done comprehensively and there's we don't have the currently have the climate for that, we like to move forward on smaller pieces like this. That's good for the immigrants, good for the economy, and good for our country.
But is the climate even right to try to even do piecemeal attempts? That's, I mean, to me, that seems to be the big question, because of all that Trump's election plus his executive orders have brought, it just seems to have more polarized the climate.
Sure. I think that one of the ways to, and we are working hard to push back on the narrative that Trump used in his campaign around immigrants, is to demonstrate and more visibly communicate the economic contributions of immigrants in this country, and that the facts show, you know, immigrants, whether they're documented or undocumented, they work. They're here to work. They're here to pay taxes, and they create jobs for Americans, right? Which, as you know, was a central theme in his campaign and in the premise for many of his policies in the last 2 weeks. You know, I was just in central Illinois a couple months right before the inauguration, and we did a roundtable with farm employers, with the local university, with medium-sized and smaller-sized manufacturers. And it was funny because one of the participants showed up because he said, I read this flyer, and I thought that this meeting was about how I can find more Mexican workers. And are we talking about a policy, or are you going to actually tell me where I can hire more Mexican workers? And so when we talked about to him more, and he said, look, you know, the work that I do on my farm is that we care for cattle, and we have, you know, orange and soybean and corn crops. And he says, you know, my best workers have been, you know, immigrants and Mexicans that have been with me for 15, 20 years. And he says, I love to hire native born, and we pay $15 to $18 an hour, right? And I advertise everywhere, but very few show up. And when they do, the native born, they're here for a few days and they quit because the job is dirty and it's hard. And, you know, and I mean, and that's to say that I think that a lot of, to the myth of immigrants, you know, take jobs, or immigrants do not keep our communities safe. I think it's important that we put out the facts and we put out these stories to show that it actually, like, immigrants do jobs that a lot of times native-borns do not want to do. But by doing those jobs, they create opportunities and jobs that native-borns, you know, do prefer, right? Like, for example, in the restaurant industry, Sam Toya, who's on our board, always talks about that immigrants are the ones doing back of the house. They do the dishwashers, you know. They clean the floors. They clean the bathrooms, jobs that, you know, native-borns don't apply for. And then by doing that, they create jobs for front of the house, the hostess, the waitress, and jobs that, you know, native-born would prefer and apply for. And so it's an ecosystem that's complementary rather than competitive. So, you know, we have, you know, these stories across different industry sectors, and I think that that's the narrative, and that those are the facts that we're going to continue to push out. And, you know, there was a study by the FBI Crime Data Lab a couple weeks ago showing that places where immigrants live and where the communities grow because of immigrants are actually safer than places that do not see that growth. And because, you know, immigrants, when they move into a community, the first thing they do is that they try to open a business, right? And they go to church, or their kids are at the schools and they get involved. And so what immigrants do is that they strengthen the processes and these institutions that are important for crime control.
All right, Rebecca, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Don't mean to cut you short there, but there is a story to tell, and it's an ecosystem that exists. But Rebecca Shih, Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition, thanks very much for joining me this
morning. Thank you so much for having me, Rick. Always a pleasure.
We'll be back with more right after this. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Todd Meisch, Susana Mendoza, the State Comptroller, and Rebecca Shih from the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. And on this fine Super Bowl Sunday,
let's play football.
I thought you were bringing the wings.
This day is all about food for me and entertainment.
Yes.
I don't know anybody who cares about the game today.
I said that to start the program. I said, and I said, partly because of just how the Bears were so bad.
Maybe.
I wasn't really into football, NFL football this year.
Yeah, and not into it. It's it's a national holiday.
It's ads and Lady Gaga is the whole deal.
Yeah, I don't even think it's ads so much anymore. I think that's like,
well, yeah, that because
from the
out.
1980s, it was the ads. It's all the ads. I think most everyone has seen all the ads already.
Yeah.
So I think it's Gaga. Whether or not she's going to mention the president,
right?
I don't think she's going to. I think she'll talk about all the things that she has always talked about in her concerts, loving one another, inclusion, caring for one another. Those have been themes in her concerts forever, and I think she'll talk about that. And apparently she's going to have drones all over the place.
I heard that, yes, and they had to get special permission from the FAA. Because,
crazy.
And hundreds of lit drones.
It's crazy.
Well, but it's Lady Gaga.
That's the way you do the halftime show now.
Right.
Oh, not like the days when Carol Channing did the halftime show. Back in the day. That really happened,
Carol,
by the way. Carol Channing and Mickey Rooney did the halftime show at one time.
Wow.
Seriously. Be thankful for a Lady Gaga is all I'm
saying.
Wow. We'll talk more about that coming up later
on. Thank God there was no costume malfunction in that.
Mickey, stop it.